back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I have a cold, but wild horses could not keep me away from you guys.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends. So happy.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, the public has bad taste. Okay, yeah, we know that. We already knew that. I mean, specifically, though, in a sort of AI art Turing test hosted by Scott Alexander of Slate Star Codex, polls of his readers showed fairly consistently that audiences couldn't discern between the difference between AI-generated art and art created by human masters, right? And in many cases, preferred the AI-generated art. Indeed, the most liked piece of art in the poll was an AI-created impressionist painting of a man at a cafe. Now, as Max Reed notes in his write-up of Alexander's poll, there are all sorts of hedges here, among them that reducing paintings to images on a screen and then comparing those images to images created for a screen, it's not really a fair test of what a painting is or what it's supposed to evoke. As Reed puts it, quote, if you want to be really tediously clear about what's being tested here, it's the ability of generative AI to mimic a compressed reproduction of an actual painting in a manner that is more immediately pleasing to an Astral Codex 10 subscriber, end quote. Now, still, as Reed says, the point of this poll is probably true and accurate, at least in the sense that AI art has gotten pretty good at creating a simulation of human art. Or to put it another way, art fit for office walls, right? These are the sort of paintings you put up in a dentist's office to soothe the patients before they go back there and face the drill. There's a movie from the 2000s called Untitled that basically tackled this idea from the art house side of things. You had this modernist composer whose music is fundamentally kind of dumb, but genuinely evocative of his personal torment. And he's kind of positioned against his brother, who does these kind of faux, abstract, hugely successful things that are empty, blank, soulless, you know, crap art. Is the world worse off if AI replaces the soulless hacks? Does it matter that much if people prefer AI kitsch to regular kitsch, to human-created kitsch? Does it matter if people prefer kitsch to genuinely evocative art? I don't know. Those are all interesting questions. Maybe we'll have answers for them. But for the moment, I just want to focus on, you know, we, or at least I, sometimes get hung up on the ethics of AI, right? The use of machine learning to strip mine the culture for bit pieces that then gets reassembled into increasingly cloying and kitschy ways. The Atlantic last month highlighted the fact that the dialogue of hundreds of thousands of screenplays has been fed into AI tools in order to create programs that help write, you know, quote unquote, new dialogue. There are genuine questions about how fair use can be stretched, how far it can go before it just, like, breaks entirely and, you know, loses all meaning. Set all that aside, there's none of that really changes the fact that people prefer sentimental hokum and kitschy slop to stuff that is, you know, again, quote unquote, good, to stuff that is critically acclaimed, to stuff that is actually emotionally successful and evocative. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying, Peter, is that the market is bad. The market is bad and it's broken. Maybe we should just get rid of it and force top down people to have the right opinions on art. Can we do that?
Yeah. So, you know, earlier today, I happened to be having a conversation about Anthony Comstock and the Comstock Laws, and he wasn't somebody with good tastes, but he did have from his position as an agent of the U.S. Postal Service, a huge influence over what kind of art could be produced, and what art could be produced legally. And so in the late 1800s, there were prosecutions under the Comstock Laws that basically amounted to Anthony Comstock doesn't like this. Therefore, it is immoral. Therefore, under U.S. law, it is obscenity, and you can go to jail for it. And in fact, some people were sent to jail and even labor camps for violating the Comstock Laws. So I do think we have a little bit of a precedent of, like, what happens when you put art in charge of one guy? and that guy works for the government or some centralized authority. Even one is nice. Everybody likes the Postal Service. It's like, it's gentle.
Yeah, nobody
it's
likes
kind.
The Postal Service. You Come know? On.
It's right. There's an office in every little small town. And sometimes it's the heart of the community. No, the Postal Service also doesn't work super well these days. It's got real serious fiscal problems going way back. But like, my point is, it's bad, actually, to do this in a centralized way. And what you want is a market system in which consumers decide, and consumers will often make choices that people on this podcast and people listening to this podcast disagree with. And that's okay. In fact, the way that that markets work is they allow us all to choose the thing that we want, and they make possible the sliver of stuff that we think is truly wonderful and truly great. And like, there's no world that produces a ton of truly great stuff without also producing a ton and probably many more tons of kind of pablum and crap. And the pablum and the crap is just part and parcel to get to the stuff that is truly wonderful. But it's also some of that crap, some of the things that many people, that even a majority of possibly our listeners to this podcast, which is a pretty niche self-selected group, even though there are a lot of you, it's certainly not like the majority of the United States or something like that, right? There would be disagreements about what constitutes crap or sentimental junk amongst our listeners. There might even be a majority of listeners who think, man, Sonny is wrong about something. And like, there's just no way to kind of deliver a world where one person or even a group of experts decides this is the good stuff, this is what we're going to allow, and that's all you get. In order to get the good stuff, you have to allow all the stuff, and you have to allow disagreement about what's good and what's not. And that makes it easier. In fact, that greases the way for having a podcast where you can talk about what you like with your friends. And like, that's part of what makes it wonderful, is having those arguments afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a straw man, though. I mean, my jokes aside, I don't think that anybody is talking about
your jokes
banning...
are the central thing here.
the jokes are what matters. I mean, I don't think anyone is legitimately talking about we need to ban AI art. Like, it needs to be illegal. I don't think anybody's really saying that. Maybe they are. I'm sure someone somewhere is like, we have to ban AI art. But that's not. I don't think that's really what's going on. Alyssa, a couple of weeks back, we were discussing a similar topic. And one of the things we had started to try to hone in on is what this does to the evolution of art, what this does to the way people think about creating art. And I look at these and I'm just like, I can't help but think that if AI is like, I wonder what is the point of what will the point of artists be, right?
Yeah.
In a world in which anybody can just use the right prompts to make the image that they want.
They're just going to be shoveling coal into the AI slot machine so that the slop can be hotter with hotter coals.
So what I'd actually really like for us to do is to take a second and actually turn the clock back about 150 years, because there's a really interesting and I think actually useful parallel for this, which is sort of the rise of the Impressionists and the end of the salon system in Paris. Because it's a really interesting story about the sort of creation and replication of taste. And if anyone is interested, after I talk about this, about going into a deep dive, my colleague Sebastian Smee has a new book out, Paris in Ruins, that is unbelievably great about all of this stuff. And I just finished it. I highly recommend it. But so, you know, in Paris in the 1860s, 1870s, art was like a big public preoccupation. And taste was kind of generated and gatekept by this institution called the Salon that, you know, put on a major show every year. To get into this, like, the process for exhibiting your work in the salon was very complicated. There was a body of judges. If you had won an award, you could submit automatically. But there was this very clear sense that, you know, sort of the tastemaking apparatus was the body that put on this exhibition that hundreds of thousands of people in, you know, late 1800s France went to every year. And they had a very clear sense of what they thought was sort of an acceptable painting, right? I mean, it was history themes, biblical themes, celebrations of the sort of martial valor of France, invisible brushstrokes, certain kinds of portraiture. And so there was this system that, you know, said, this is what good taste is. And for something to be considered good art, it has to sort of meet these parameters. It has to be like what you've done in the past. And to a certain extent, it's like an algorithm, right? It sort of tells people, and this is, I really want to emphasize, this is sort of a loose comparison, but I think it's useful. You know, it is effectively an algorithm where that says, like, this is what a painting is. This is what a successful painting is. This is what, you know, sophisticated art is. And it was sort of this self-replicating machine. And naturally, it bred dissonance, right? So you have people like Edouard Manet, who have both successfully had paintings submitted, you know, accepted into the Salon and exhibited there, but are sort of chafing to do something different. And there are a couple of attempts to sort of set up counter salons that don't quite work. And then there's this sort of disastrous year. There's the Franco-Prussian War. France essentially has a civil war and Paris gets destroyed. And a lot of the people who become the Impressionists are either exiled or living at this terrible war in the city. You know, Manet is sort of in and out of the city. Berta Morisot, who's the sole woman among the Impressionists, is like in Paris for a lot of this civil war. And, you know, the social conditions change. And so when the group that becomes known as the Impressionists exhibits again after the war, people are suddenly more receptive to things that are, you know, sort of depictions of the French landscape undestroyed by the horrors of war. They're willing to react against sort of celebrations of martial valor, history paintings, et cetera. They have been sort of socially primed for something new, and the Impressionists are ultimately able to sort of break the tastemaking apparatus of the Salon. It doesn't happen immediately. It takes a while, but for something new to come into the world, it requires people to act outside of that algorithm, act outside of that taste-making apparatus. And, you know, all of this is possible, of course, because art is a thing that people routinely go see and that they have access to and that, you know, above a certain, you know, I mean, it's not like the very poor of France are going to art galleries all of the time. But, you know, if you're middle class, like, and you're in Paris, like, you go to the Salon. It's a thing you can do. It's, you know, it's relatively affordable and it's just done. It's part of popular culture. And I don't, did either of you have to take art history at any point? You know, I don't know how many people have access to, you know, affordable museums on a regular basis. And certainly, you know, painting, for example, visual art has been really shuffled aside as a mass form of popular culture by other forms. So, you know, the Salon comparison kind of breaks down as visual art is kind of marginalized in general. But I do think there is an interesting parallel there. There are a lot of good paintings that are exhibited at the Salon over the years. But for something really exciting and new to emerge, people have to be able to operate outside of the system. And so what concerns me most about AI art is not that people will use AI to make art. People will do interesting things with it. But the idea of sort of an infinitely self-replicating art ecosystem is just not very interesting to me because, you know, until you get to artificial general intelligence, which is not where we're at yet, I don't think sort of large language models and image generators are necessarily going to have the insight to sort of break out of the algorithm, to break out of the tastemaking apparatus and make really interesting art.
Yeah. I mean, again, I don't know. Part of this whole discussion remains a real aggressively complicated discussion about what the purpose of art is, really. What is the purpose of art? Is it to reflect reality? Is it to, you know, give the artist an outlet for their emotional state? It is a complicated question that is kind of muddied by questions of technology that are almost unanswerable.
Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah.
And that's a thing that's very frustrating to me. I like having answers. You know, something's right or wrong. And
Actually one of the reasons, and there are many, why we have art is because it helps us answer questions to which there are no answers.
Yeah. And I will say, both read The Art of Rivalry, and if you're in D.C. sometime before mid-January, the National Gallery also has the touring Paris 1874, the Impressionist Moment exhibit, that chronicles a lot of these same developments and is just a really interesting way to sort of see this transition visually, but also to think about some of these questions in a different context.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that audiences can't discern which art is made by robots and which art is made by people? Peter?
It's a non-controversy. I mean, most art's going to be made by robots by, like, tomorrow, next year.
Alyssa?
It's a non-controversy just because the robots are cribbing the humans.
Well, it's a controversy, but that's only because I don't expect much from people generally anyway. So I like that's neither here nor there. It's a mild controversy because they're cribbing from humans. They, you know.
Wait. What's that quote? Good artists borrow, great artists steal. Sounds to me like AI is just a great artist.
Yes, indeed. All right. Make sure to swing by the Bulwark on Friday for a bonus episode on Juror Number 2, which hit VOD on Tuesday. It is playing in scattered theaters still around the country. Maybe you can find it at an AMC or a Cinemark near you. But if not, it's on VOD. So we'll be talking about that. And now on to the main event. Wicked, the new movie, which is based on a decades-old musical, which was adapted from a book published in the 1990s, a book that was a reimagining of an 85-year-old movie, itself a classic that was in turn based on a book that was published at the turn of the 20th century. You see this? Nothing is new.
Because in this world of human-created art that we live in, everything is totally new, and there's no sort of antecedents art that's being kind of constantly twisted and reinterpreted back on itself. It's never happened until AI.
It's all original and new. It's doing huge numbers at the domestic box office because people like slop. It's earning some Oscar buzz, too. But is it any good? Look, I am not the guy to ask that question. My opinions on musicals, I don't really like them for the most part, has earned much scorn from the listeners of this podcast and the readers of my reviews. I just don't like many non-animated movie musicals. I really don't like stage musicals. This is like the worst of all those worlds rolled into one package. But I'll just say here at the top of the show, Wicked is not for me. It's not a thing that was made for me. I think it succeeds at what it sets out to do, right? It's a big, glossy musical with songs some people seem to like and a pair of, like, genuinely heartfelt performances at the core of the thing. I'm not hedging here in an effort to avoid getting yelled at. I'm just speaking my truth, and my truth is not for me. Okay, so here's the good. The performances that I mentioned are very, very good. Cynthia Erivo plays Elphaba, the green-skinned girl who will become Wicked Witch of the West, with a sort of understated charm, right? She's a girl who's used to being gawked at and reprimanded for being in the way, so she's a little awkward, but also, you know, comfortable in herself, supposedly, when she shows up at Shiz University. Not helping matters is the fact that her roommate, Glinda, is an aggressively self-centered ditzy blonde who believes she is God's gift to magic and destined to become the Wizard of Oz's protege. There are a ton of subplots in this movie, and none of them are particularly interesting. There's one that has to do with talking animals being discriminated against. There's this authoritarian wizard who needs to invent an enemy to keep the people under his thumb or something. But the beating heart of the story, again, is that growing friendship between Glinda and Elphaba. And the centerpiece of that relationship comes during a musical number set inside an underwater club. Elphaba has been invited by Glinda to this party so she can mock the girl, the green-skinned girl. Elphaba shows up and she holds her head high. She's dancing by herself. She's fighting back tears. And, you know, Glinda realizes that, oh my God, she's not, you know, so confident. She has been, you know, putting on a brave face. I will join her. I will throw my umbrella of popularity over her. I will save her from scorn. Their scene together there is really, again, just genuinely touching. There were sniffles all over the theater where I was watching it. It worked. It worked for what it was supposed to do. Ariana Grande delivers, I think, one of the best performances of the year in this movie. Again, I don't really like musicals, but I was close to getting into this one. She's so effusively clueless that it skips right over being annoying and into charming. She just, like, she has it in this movie, right? That undefinable.
She's this year's Ken, right? Like, it's the Ken performance.
Yeah, kind of. That's not a bad way of putting it. Like, she's like the female version of Ken. But also she's also Barbie though, right? Because she's also the one who has the power. I don't know. It's weird. It's just a great performance. I don't know what to tell you. I enjoyed watching her on screen even when she was being, you know, awful. Look again, this movie, not for me. It feels like it's a million hours long. This movie is 2 hours and 40 minutes or something like that. And it's only half the story. It's only the first act of the play. The musical numbers are relatively unmemorable. I couldn't sing a single line from any of the songs. I couldn't tap out any of the melodies. The actual filmmaking of it is kind of interesting, but only if you kind of compare it to other older musicals, because director John Chu has really internalized the music video style of cross-cutting between places. He doesn't really show fluidity of dance movement. It's about creating a rhythm through cutting. Some people don't like that. I don't really care. I grew up watching music videos. I don't find it offensive. Some people very much did not care for it. Visually, it's kind of weirdly brown and gray. It's less like, you know, Wizard of Oz the movie and more like a Zack Snyder movie, frankly. And setting aside Jeff Goldblum, he's always charming, especially in his huckster mode, which he is very much in this movie. I found almost all of the other performances to be at best annoying and at worst like cringe, to use a word. Bowen Yang, you are cringe in this movie. I'm sorry. I can't in good conscience recommend it to anyone. That said, I also recognize that people who are into this sort of thing are going to be very into it. And the box office and cinema scores have very handily demonstrated that fact. Again, not my jam, Alyssa. Was it yours?
It was not. I was frustrated by this. And I should say that I am not... I like musicals more than I think any of us by a wide, wide margin. But I was never a Wicked person. I think that, you know, the...
That's for sure.
Well, I mean...
Hi-oh.
I know. I'm such a saint. Sorry. But I don't find this sort of an exceptionally strong score. Defying Gravity is one of the sort of, is probably like the undisputed musical theater banger of the millennium so far. It's like, it's a great song. But I find the music in this really inconsistent. And I think the way it's handled here is really technically poor. And I am not the speaker person in this podcast, but I found the mixing on this really, really bad. I saw this at my local Alamo Draft House where like sound is calibrated properly, picture is calibrated properly. I could not tell what the lyrics were to the opening number in a consistent way. The music is like consistent. And I went back and listened to the cast recording a couple of times to see if this was like a theater specific problem. And in fact, the music is frequently, the background music is frequently drowning out Ariana Grande in particular. There are a couple of exceptions. What is this feeling and popular and Defying Gravity? Like she comes through clearly, but like the music eats the lyrics and specifically eats the singing performances in a bunch of these numbers in a way that, you know, does a disservice to the sort of like narrative progression of the musical, but also just undermines the two lead actresses who have really strong voices and give really strong performances, but are just drowned out. And Peter, I don't know if that was your experience as well, but like, I just thought the mixing on this was bizarre. And I went back and I've been listening to the cast recording from In the Heights, which John Chu also directed, and which is really, really crisp. And it's a very different kind of score, but even so, like you can hear every single lyric in every single song in The Heights. And stuff just gets muddy and disappears in the songs here, which is a huge problem in a musical.
Alyssa, Peter, I do want you to answer this question in a second. I want to say that I am totally with you on this, Alyssa. I'm not a musical guy, and one of the reasons I'm not a musical guy is because I've always had some trouble parsing lyrics as they are sung, as they are part of the, you know, part of the plot of the story or the dialogue or whatever. I've always had an issue with that. So I just kind of assumed this was more of that, but I'm with you. The opening song that Ariana Grande sings as Glinda was totally incomprehensible to me. I like could not understand what was going on in it.
I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but one of the reasons I am a musical person is because I have a kind of freakish ear for an ability to memorize lyrics. And so the fact that I literally couldn't tell what was going on, like if neither of us could, that is an indication that something just went technically wrong here in a strange way.
So just imagine listening to all music like that for your whole life. And think about how it would change your relationship to music, because that is frequently how things are for me. I greatly struggle to process lyrics. It's not that I literally cannot hear any words in any songs ever, but I struggle to process lyrics when I'm listening to songs. And even many of my favorite albums that I've listened to dozens or more times, I can't sing along with the songs. I can like hum along with the melodies, and to me, it just plays in the voices are just another instrument. It's like it might as well be the Charlie Brown trombone voice, right? It's just like wah, 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 wah. But it's like there's a musicality to it and a texture, and so I care a lot about the texture of voices much more than about lyrics themselves.
I also just want to say, I think that Sunny, you mentioned the length, and this does feel really long. And I think part of the problem in probably the staging, and I haven't seen this on Broadway, so I can't tell if this is a problem with just like the book, the way the show is written. Although I believe the original clocks in, like both acts clock in shorter than this does. The songs are really strung out. And in fact, I think the sort of the staging of Defying Gravity at the end of the movie is just kind of theatrical malpractice, because they keep breaking the song up with these action beats when like actually you should, the recorded version of it is like 7.5 minutes long. And it's longer than that in the theater, because there are moments when there's not singing. There's just like Elphaba flying around on a blue broomstick. Like,
I specifically read it just at like, there's a relevant note here. I read an interview with director John Chu, I believe, or maybe one of the other principals involved in the film, where they said that any change they made from the stage show had to be additive. And so every single thing that they did to significantly depart from the stage show was to add something here.
But why would you take one of the great musical theater numbers of like the last 25 years and just sort of chop it up like that instead of just letting it rip? Because it's a great, like it is a great musical theater number, right? It's like as sort of a, it is, musicals usually have something called sort of like an I want number, that's sort of the expression of longing that will kind of drive the plot. And so
I were a rich man.
Yeah, that, The Wizard and I is an I want song, but like Defying Gravity is sort of both an I want song and a twist on it. It's amazingly well executed. It's this incredible vocal showcase, and you just chop it up and ruin its momentum. And what's weird is that John Chu can do more interesting things than this, right? Like, if you think back, I don't know if you guys remember 96,000, the sequence set around a big municipal swimming pool in the Heights, right? Which is, goes from character to character. It goes from singing to rapping. Like, it touches like basically every character in the show. But it all builds to this sort of huge panoramic, like, Esther Williams aquatic ballet sequence at the pool. But he doesn't have to break it up. He just keeps it going. And I think slowing down that number in particular is just kind of an illustration to me, not just of the technical problems with this movie, but with just some real cinematic misjudgment. That's a bummer because there's fun acting going on here. Like, Jonathan Bailey is, you know, really good at kind of projecting raffishness and longing. Like, he makes that tension seem real. You know, Erivo's good. Grande is great. I think this is a real waste of Michelle Yeoh, but that's sort of neither here nor there.
Yeah, this is not a good movie for her, frankly.
Yeah, it's just very frustrating. It's a fun moment to moment, but a lot of it's just not good.
Peter, did you watch it in Dolby IMAX? What was your viewing experience?
I saw this in Dolby at the local Alamo, and I did not particularly love it. I would say it's probably the second best musical directed by the guy who made G.I. Joe Retaliation after the pandemic. It's just not for me in so many ways, but also a movie that, like, in some way, I do think this movie kind of delivers for its audience. There's a slickness to it, a kind of a polish to the rhythms of it, I think. And there's a very cohesive design sensibility. This movie looks expensive, but it also looks terrible. And it's interesting in the way, like, how expensive it looks and how much it looks like a bunch of quite skilled craftspeople put a lot of work into this movie, which then nonetheless looks awful. It is just unpleasant to look at. Every one of the effects shots looks like it was rendered on a PS5. The color palette is washed out and sort of muddy. And even more than those specific things, there's never a moment where the camera rests and looks around and shows you something epic and lets you take in a moment, and gives you a sense of awe at the magic and the fantasy of this world. And that's, I think, a real betrayal of, like, the joy of and the wonder of the original Wizard of Oz, which is, as I've said on this podcast before, a movie I watched many times as a kid. And even in the 1980s, in our sort of, you know, post-Star Wars, big Hollywood sequel world, where I had seen movies with modern special effects, The Wizard of Oz, at least through the time I was a kid and into being, you know, a young teenager, really managed to sell that sense of awe. And this was a big part of what it delivered, was this giant scale magic and mystery of a fantasy world that brought viewers into that sense of awe, but also the characters. And this is a big thing that you saw in the original Wizard of Oz, was that the characters themselves were just amazed by this weird magical fantasy world that they were dancing around in. And so in some ways it almost justified the dancing and the singing, because they were in such a hallucinatory place that was so brilliant and wonderful that of course they would just start dancing. And this movie, despite all the special effects, despite the practical effects that we know they built that stupid train. This movie just doesn't in any way inspire any kind of awe. And it's a missed opportunity, but it also just makes the movie feel kind of flat and, frankly, turgid at times. Just like, it's just not a very pleasant movie to watch. And you combine that with I think there's good things about the two central performances, but overall, this movie really felt kind of smug and self-satisfied to me. It doesn't want to complicate much of anything for the characters. Its narrative is so morally simplistic, so straightforward. And there's nothing here that sort of gives it any kind of friction or any kind of darkness or anything to sort of work with. And I was thinking about what makes this. So I am not as big a fan of musicals as Alyssa is, but there are musicals that I like, and in particular, over the past couple of years, I really liked La La Land, and I also really liked Steven Spielberg's West Side Story adaptation. And I was thinking about West Side Story, which I watched again earlier this year, and there's a couple of things that are different. One is that score is incredible, and it's mixed in a way that's really incredible. It's not just that you can hear stuff, it's that you can hear those individual instruments, and they sound like instruments, which I know is a weird thing to say, but they actually sound like what the specific instrument is supposed to sound like. And there's this fantastic like dynamism to the music and narrative drive to just to the music on its own. And then the photography in that movie is also just phenomenal. And forget even the technically complex shots, you know, like that incredible flyover in the high school dance scene that Spielberg does. Just any of his still shots, the quieter ones, you look at the light and there's darkness. And that's like maybe like the simple way of saying it is I hated this movie's black levels. Like the contrast ratio on this film annoyed the hell out of me throughout, even when they got into some of the darker shots in the Emerald City. It just looked sludgy and flat and ugly. And in part, that was because for the first 2 hours, there are no shadows. And then at the end, it's just this sort of, I don't even know how to describe it. It doesn't look, there's no drama to it. There's no spikiness. There's no edge to it. It's so pat and flat and uninspired throughout. And this movie just has a lot of reverence, I think, for the relationship at the center, but it has no sort of sense of greatness within itself about like what the story is or the world, or there's just this like lack of epicness to this film, which is very strange for a big expensive fantasy film that does, like I said, I realize I'm sitting here trashing the craft work on this film, and it looks like everyone on this film is very talented, and also like the fundamental vision that drove it was just a bad and unpleasant one.
And I think that shows through in the plotting as well, right? Like, it is notable, for example, that like we never get any indication that Glinda has actually learned how to do any magic, right? Like, we have no indication of like what's happening to the animals. Like, there are people who are losing their speech, but they're not in cages. Like, I mean, that all that plot is just sort of strung together in such a weird and shoddy way. And there's
the animal plot is just there to make us sympathize with Elphaba, right? It's weird. You're supposed to sympathize with Elphaba because of the animals, but it doesn't make any effort to make you sympathize with the animals aside from this one tiny little bit with the animals in the cages. You need to care about them for that bit to work.
And there's no coherent theory of like how magic works or like how it's, you know, why it's been receding from the world, or, you know, why the wizard is sort of a credible figure to anyone, right? I mean, he's just sort of asserted. There is just sort of a lack of, and I mean, the characters' motivations and the plot beats are as sort of mechanical and unconvincing as the wizard's head itself, right? There's just, things happen because they need to happen, not because they sort of spin out of authentic human behavior or motivations. It's a very odd movie.
Well, a part of the problem here is that it's half a movie. Again, yeah. it's half a story. So I assume that there's some big reason that we'll learn why the animals need to be treated like.
No, there's like, is if it follows the course of the, like, of the stage show, that will not be the case.
Okay, so I don't know. There's a subplot with Elphaba's half-sister who, you know, is in a wheelchair, and like they, you know, she's in love with somebody and that person's in love. And like that, again, this just kind of stops. That subplot is left hanging because, again, I assume that we'll pick up, you know, in part number two. The plotting, the storytelling of this movie, Peter, I think the word you used was, It's kind of smug. It's kind of like smugly full of itself, and the whole oppression of the animal subplot is the sort of thing that is inserted into a thing to say, look at how important this is. Look, this is an important musical. It's not just singing and dancing. We have a point. It's not just, you know, you got to be nice to people. It's about oppression. And like, I don't care. I don't care about any of these things because I'm not given a reason to care about any of these things.
The reason to care is because you loved Wicked on Broadway.
I guess. I didn't, though, is the thing. I've never seen it. I will never see it.
But that's, I think, I don't know. To me, this movie feels like it doesn't do a good job of translating whatever the appeal of the Broadway show is. At the same time, I think it's pretty clear that many, many viewers feel differently. And I don't totally, I'll confess, I kind of get like that this movie delivers on the thing that it promises. But I don't like that thing at all. And maybe this is, I think I would have preferred this if it had been directed by AI is what I'm saying.
Oh boy. The three of us are very much in the minority here again. It's gotten very good scores on Rotten Tomatoes. Audiences seem to be very into it. It's probably going to win like 13 Oscars or something. Yeah.
And a number of critics who I quite like really liked this film and it just wasn't for me.
Yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. I would not be offended if Ariana Grande was nominated for an Academy Award for this because, I think she's really, really good in it, but it's not a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Wick? I've got an idea. Peter.
Thumbs down. It's no step up to the streets.
Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
Yeah, thumbs down. Sorry, folks. You can yell. You're going to yell at us. That's fine. Whatever. I'm used to it by now. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday!